because of foreign wars we wage. More to do with the colors blue and red. Too many laws and too much government. Can you tell me where the Constitution went? The Bill of Rights is just hanging by a thread. So many people trying to cross the border. Politicians build a new world order. Too many minds are convinced they should be led. I've gotta be free the way God made sense. And I won't be ruled by the dance. Right to self-defense. They say you're stable, but they don't make sense. Dangerous money will not turn into guns. All the food you know is asking for. All you buy is made on foreign shores. Come a day when you'll be real hell to pay. I've gotta be free.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast of Tapping to the Truth. Hope you're having a fantastic day wherever you are and whatever you may be doing, with all the usual caveats, of course. But as always, I'm your ever so humble host, Tim Tap, coming to you live from historic Roane County, Tennessee. And as always, I am so very glad to have you here with me today. Thank you for giving up a little bit of your time to listen to the ramblings of some crazy guy somewhere in Tennessee. All right, so if you are at the BTR home platform, then you see in today's show description links to a couple of recently published articles of mine, one of which I kind of went over on air with you, Teenagers Attacking People, Nothing to See Here. That, of course, was posted over at Patriots USA, published there. And then an article that I'm probably more proud of where it was published as opposed to the article itself. Now, the article is titled, Hasn't the Government Done Enough for Elon Musk? Now, if you are not listening at the BTR home platform, you are, of course, welcome to Google that. And it should take you over to the great conservative website, American Greatness. You know, to be published alongside folks like Victor Davis Hanson, suddenly I feel extremely honored and humbled, and I am so very grateful for that fact. So again, Hasn't the Government Done Enough for Elon Musk, published near the end of last month at American Greatness. So if you are so inclined, check it out. If you are at the BTR platform and you are looking at the show description, the link should be active and should take you there, should you be interested. Also, if you are listening at BTR, and I see folks are starting to call in to listen, the ongoing technical glitch here at the home platform is still ongoing. No chat room available, and no live listening, which means you'll have to be listening in the archives, listening after the fact. So those of you who choose to hop on the horn and listen that way, thank you so very much. I believe that looks like Chief, at least at Chief's area code, that is on the line right now. So welcome to the show, Chief. I'm glad to have you here. Anyway, enough said. I've only got an hour tonight, which means I've really got to get into it. I've got three stories in the show description, and I've got one that I'm going to start with before that. All of this is stuff that probably was much fresher yesterday. Yesterday, at the time of this broadcast, would have been Monday. But things I definitely wanted to talk about, and there's a lot of stuff that happened today that will probably get moved into the Wednesday night live show. So tune back in if you're so interested. But big news in so much that we've had a federal judge that's tossed out the House Democrats lawsuit that has been designed to stop President Donald Trump's use of emergency military funds on the border wall. Washington, D.C. District Court Judge Trevor McFadden threw out the House Democrats lawsuit seeking an injunction against President Trump's emergency border wall funding reallocation, saying that the matter is fundamentally a political dispute and that the politicians lack standing to make a legal case. Now, I am okay with them tossing it out. I'm not sure that that's a legitimate legal grounds to do it. Anyway, Trump, of course, had declared a national emergency this past February over the humanitarian crisis that's currently still ongoing at our southern border. Once Congress failed to fund the border wall, of course, House Speaker Nancy Mimi Pelosi and House Democrats then filed a suit back in April of this year, charging that Trump was stealing from appropriated funds by moving $6.7 billion from other projects towards border wall construction. Democrats argued that the White House had flouted the fundamental separation of powers principles and usurped for itself legislative power specifically vested by the Constitution to the Congress. Now, I can almost buy into that argument with the one rather glaring exception. And that is, of course, that funds that are allocated to the military budget but aren't specified for purposes are therefore free to be moved around. And that has been common practice, well, pretty much as long as we've had a budget and Congress has been funding our military. It's an ongoing thing. It's so normalized that nobody raised an eyebrow, except, of course, for the House Democrats that cannot stand for the fact that they raised such a stink, practically fell on their swords to keep the wall from being built, and yet Donald Trump found a way to beat them anyway. So they filed the lawsuit. Okay, da-da-da-da-da, do what you do. I do think that given this argument, they do have the legal standing to have the case heard at the federal level. So I'm not necessarily buying into Judge McFadden's reasons for dismissing the case. But I do, however, think that it should be dismissed because for the very reasons I just laid out. As I mentioned, this fundamental separation of powers is a legitimate argument. But like I said, there is this big, huge differential between whether or not these dollars had actually been allocated for something specific. And as the commander-in-chief, it is well within the rights of the chief executive, the occupier of the White House at any particular given time, the current president of the United States, to determine that military funds that are not specifically allocated to any particular projects can, in fact, be moved around a bit, particularly and especially in the event of a national emergency, which he declared. And I think that you can make a very legitimate, whether you like Donald Trump or not, at this point in time, even the Democrats are starting to acknowledge the humanitarian crisis going on at the border. I think Donald Trump can make a legitimate argument. Or if you don't like hearing anything from Orange Man Bad, then I think reasonable people, not even involved with the government, can make a reasonable and quite a compelling case for why not having real control over our southern border is a national defense issue, something the military should, in fact, be, maybe kind of working on, solving the problem. Military funds may not be a bad route to go. Now, we've had that discussion, of course, back when it first happened. So, you know, kind of rehashing old stuff here. But in this particular ruling, McFadden, who for some reason the media seems insistent on pointing out that McFadden is in fact a Donald Trump appointee, not that that could factor in, McFadden suggested Democrats were trying to circumvent the political process, which I guess in a lot of ways that is somewhat legitimate, because the political process here is the give and take of Democrats trying to stop the president from having any kind of win. The political process itself probably should be circumvented. And again, I think the judge probably could have been a little more legal in his explanations as far as what's going on, because he's making it sound like he too is a political operator. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think that that was the intent. And I really don't know that McFadden's interest here is covering the boss, if you will, which, of course, is the accusation by the media and all the Democrats involved, which is why they're going absolutely apoplectic in regards to Donald Trump continuing to get federal judge appointees in place. He's getting to pick a lot of them, and he's putting conservatives in place, and – yeah, it still comes back to the fact that Democrats know what they look for in a judge. They want a judge that's going to be an activist for their side, regardless of what the Constitution says, regardless of what the law says. They want an activist. They want people that are going to legislate from the bench as necessary. And more importantly, right now, they want somebody that's going to smack down Donald Trump any chance he gets. Well, they don't have that with Trump appointees. But you know what? I almost wish that this had been an Obama or a Clinton appointee and still come out with this dismissal of the case, because then they can't make the argument that this is just a political effort. I mean, we see what they're doing with AG William Barr in regards to trying to hold him in contempt now. We're moving forward. We're holding you in contempt of Congress for doing his job. All right, well, if that's what it takes, carry on. all political. So, at any rate, quoting now, this case presents a close question about the appropriate role of the judiciary in resolving disputes between the other two branches of the federal government. To be clear, the court does not imply that Congress may never sue the executive to protect its powers. The court declines to take sides in this fight between the House and the president. Now, this is all part of Judge McFadden's opinion as it was released. Now, McFadden's ruling contrasted with the U.S. District Court Judge Haywood Gillum's injunction that came last week, which of course blocked the administration from using the reallocated funds for projects in specific areas in Texas and Arizona. Gillum had been appointed by then President Barack Obama. Again, important to notice, in case you're wondering if maybe these judges are just playing politics. Unfortunately, in both these cases, there's nothing that indicates that they may not be, other than the fact that McFadden does seem to actually be following the law. So McFadden began by focusing on two guiding Supreme Court cases that he calls lodestars. The 2015 case, Arizona State Legislator versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, and the that's a very famous one, and the 1997 case, Raines versus Byrd, which, you know, Infamy. Okay, so back to the opinion. Read together, Raines and Arizona State Legislator create a spectrum of sorts. On one end individual legislators lack standing to allege a generalized harm to Congress's Article I power. On the other end, both chambers of a state legislature do have standing to challenge a nullification of their legislative authority brought about through a referendum. But McFadden also very quickly distinguished that the Arizona state legislature case, which found institutional standing for legislators only in a limited instance. The Arizona case, the judge noted, does not touch or concern the question whether Congress has standing to bring a suit against the president. And the Supreme Court has found there was no federal analog to Arizona's initiative power. So Democrats' dispute was more similar to the one in the Raines case. Under that framework and factors that are part of the Raines case, including how similar matters have been handled historically and the availability of other remedies besides litigation, McFadden then ruled that the House Democrats lacked the standing to issue this case. So concerning past historical practice, the Trump administration argued in its brief that when Congress was concerned about unauthorized executive branch spending in the aftermath of World War I, it responded not by threatening litigation, but by creating the General Accounting Office. The judge also cited that argument approvingly in his opinion, calling it persuasive. Now, as it all comes down to, I could continue on from the article and commenting as we go, but the bottom line here is we still haven't seen the end of this. It's going to be pushed forward, but it's really, really difficult for the Democrats at this point to continue on because the previous injunction will be wiped out by this ruling, and we'll see what happens. I, for one, think it will be quite interesting to watch as the tit-for-tat constant battle continues on. All right, see that we have somebody else who's joined in on the phone lines. Hey, welcome to the show. Glad to have you listening in. Thank you. So now the main crux of tonight's focus, we have been touching on for the last couple of weeks how bad things have gotten in Los Angeles. Now, seems like pretty much everybody and their grandmother is talking about it. We discussed last week how Dr. Drew, not exactly a bastion of conservative thought, had come out and was basically calling out the city of Los Angeles, now saying that it did not meet the sanitary standards of medieval Europe. We were talking about the bubonic plague possibly being present at that point. Well, we've also been talking about the fact that there have been reports of typhoid fever. Now, as of Monday, it was officially announced that there are officers with the Los Angeles Police Department that have fallen ill. Now, at least six, and that number is inevitably going to grow as long as the current conditions remain the same. But at least six Los Angeles Police Department officers right now from the same downtown precinct are showing signs of typhoid fever and a typhus-like illness after working in or near the city's growing homeless encampment. Now, it's important to note that that is specific, that they all had worked near the encampment, not just part of the same precinct, because some of the folks that work in the precinct don't work near the homeless encampment. They have a different beat. All right, they're operating in different areas within the precinct. So that helps to eliminate the cause of the issue being the station itself. That's not to say that as more officers get sick and come back, that there's not the possibility of spreading about some diseases, and the precinct itself is currently under a special sanitizing regimen, which will not be good enough to prevent the spread of disease, by the way, as long as officers have to continue to go down and work this part of the precinct. As I mentioned last week, Dr. Drew Pinsky made headlines across the country. We talked about it right here, declaring that Los Angeles is, in fact, the epicenter of a public health emergency, which, of course, is stemming from the growing homeless population. It finds nothing wrong with setting up permanent encampments across large swaths of the city's downtown area. And Dr. Drew cautioned at that point that unless city officials took immediate action, it's likely the homeless population of L.A. could see an outbreak of the bubonic plague. Now, again, as I did when we talked about this last week, I'd like to remind everyone that the bubonic plague is also known throughout the majority of Europe during the Middle Ages as the Black Death. Killed a lot of people. So the plague, of course, killed tens of millions across Europe back in the 14th century, you know, before the advent of public sanitation and clean water systems, yeah, things like that. Things like city officials in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco and all throughout the western coast, as far as that's concerned, major cities should be providing. You know, we've known about this for a while now. Anyway, Pinsky recalled speaking to Fox News host Laura Ingraham, that Los Angeles is suffering from a complete lack of sanitation, and there's not even a strategy in place. And just as these serious communicable diseases seem to be taking root, the city council is considering a ban on using rat poison. A lot of these illnesses are, in fact, spread via the rodents, or, in some cases, fleas that are living on the rodents. So let's make it harder to kill the rats. That makes perfect sense. The timing is impeccable. At any rate, what I'm discussing here tonight is the fact that six Los Angeles Police Department officers, including at least one detective who has already been diagnosed with typhoid fever. So far, still, even at this moment, the only one that is confirmed to be typhoid fever, just the other five are showing all the symptoms. I would imagine that will be confirmed very soon, unless I've just missed it. The city's police union announced late Saturday, this past weekend, that five others are showing symptoms of the same rare illness. So typhus and typhoid fever are spread through contaminated food and water and through fleas and ticks. The six officers who work at the city's Central Division station may have come into contact with the disease while policing the city's growing homeless encampments. May have. I'm using air quotes here, may have, allegedly. Particularly what we're talking about here is Skid Row, which is in the Central Division's district. Or it could have actually simply happened from interacting within the station itself, which is something that folks are quick to point out. Now, if you were out at Skid Row and you contracted the disease, you may have been contagious before you were showing symptoms. So, yes, I suppose it's possible that not all of the officers that sick actually contracted it while out on the beat. But, again, I will point out that all six of the officers, including the detective, all work in the area that puts them down on Skid Row. Now, the Associated Press has also reported that the Central Division station could be an issue, and that the state investigation into conditions in and around the Central Division station has begun. Now, all this brings about several questions. This state investigation, in fact, did turn up a myriad of public health issues, landing the building a $5,000 fine in order to clean it up immediately. But the city's police officers union say it isn't that simple. In other words, this is a cover job. They're trying to distract you. The shiny, flashy. It's like if you're watching the movie Up and your little favorite dog there is it Squirrel. Look over here, please. The building's in such bad shape. That's why you're getting sick. Here's a $5,000 fine, which, of course, the city will take care of because that means the taxpayers are going to pay for it. And yakety smackety, blah, blah, blah. Everything's good. That's all it is. Let's not look at the real problem. The police officers union, however, they want you to look at the real problem. Los Angeles needs to get serious about breaking up homeless encampments, even if they feel a sense of progressive empathy over them, before they become a widespread public health hazard. Now, it's important to remember the key word in that phrasing is widespread. They are already a public health hazard. That's why so many big cities for an extremely large period of time in this country's history have not allowed homeless encampments to remain in one area. That's why they haven't allowed them to grow exponentially. That's why they would rouse these people out rather than let them settle in and get comfortable and think that they can actually square out yardage and take up so much of the sidewalk. Well, this is now this is where I live. This is my place now. That's literally what they have going on in Los Angeles now. If you don't start breaking up these encampments, if you don't start dealing with this crisis, and it is exactly that, if you don't start dealing with it in a mature and reasonable fashion, start treating the mentally ill homeless the way mentally ill people should be treated, and start helping people get to shelters who are homeless through no fault of their own, and be insistent that the option to stay on the street is not an option that they have, until you do those things, this is only going to continue to spiral out of control. Now, in addition to typhus and typhoid fever, the potential, the plague, is very strong. Officers of LAPD's Central Division Station contend routinely with cases of hepatitis A and staph infections. And a union spokesperson was telling this to a press conference this past Saturday. Spokesperson said, quote, "The last thing I need is my members coming to work worried about contracting an infectious disease and bringing it home to their families." Infectious disease experts spoke to the Associated Press, saying that conditions inside the station would have had a marked effect on the spread of the illness, like typhus. The police union agrees and believes the city of Los Angeles should make keeping police officers safe and improving their working conditions a top priority. Now, still, this is being used to divert your attention away from the problem, the homeless encampment. The homeless encampments in the city of Los Angeles, who they just finished a legal negotiation with people that were representing the homeless in their city, to now allow them to keep things like couches and sofas as long as they're not blocking – listen carefully – as long as they're not blocking the sidewalks. It doesn't mean that they can't actually be out onto the sidewalk to a degree. It just – there still has to be room for people to walk by them. Old sofas are a great place for rodents to take cover on the streets. They're also allowed to keep refrigerators. Refrigerators that aren't working, they're just being used for storage purposes. They're finding old, tossed, thrown out refrigerators. and they're able to roll them to their spot. And again, as long as you're not blocking the sidewalk, not completely clear of the sidewalk, just not blocking the sidewalk, the city's going to allow it. City really didn't get much in the way of concessions from the homeless in this case either, which I'm not really going to go too far into. It's ridiculous. Instead of negotiating with these folks, they need to be actually helping them. I mean, they are supposed to be the compassionate ones, right? We are talking about a city that's run by leftists. We're talking about a city that's run by people that have a D at the end of their name, a city that is run by folks that claim that their level of compassion is immeasurable. Well, their compassion is about to cause a health crisis in their city for their actual tax-paying citizens, the folks that pay their salaries, the people they're actually supposed to be working for. And let us not even begin to broach the idea, the notion of the impact their so-called sanctuary status may also be adding to the issue. Because let's just go ahead and throw in some unimmunized individuals from third world countries that could possibly be carrying who knows how many other diseases that have been previously eradicated from the United States, and we'll just protect them from any type of legal ramifications. Now, also, if you've been paying attention, and I know you have, Los Angeles, it's not the only city facing these kind of problems, and it's certainly not the first time that Los Angeles has faced typhus and typhoid fever. Several years ago, when the homeless population temporarily exploded, LA faced a small outbreak of the disease that led to a massive cleanup. This time around, however, like its sister city, San Francisco, Los Angeles city government, it isn't exactly chomping at the bit, if you will, to address the root cause of the problem, which is the rampant homelessness. It doesn't want to address the problem. It much rather address issues that don't bring attention to the problem. In San Francisco, there's a similar threat of disease, particularly given that the sidewalks and the public ways across the city are littered with human waste and hypodermic needles. And of course, it has homeless encampments now that have gotten so crowded that some parts of the transient population are now building these makeshift boats so that they can live out in San Francisco's famous bay. Again, this is all information that we have talked about before, but what makes it different now is the fact that we have police officers who are put at risk because they still have to go down into these districts, but you know darn well they're not allowed to actually address the real problem. And until that takes place, if you live in the city of Los Angeles, even if you're hiding behind a gated community, even if you're uber wealthy and you're able to stay away from certain parts of town, you are still going to face an extremely serious issue before long. All right, so looking at the clock, it's about at the halfway point, ran a little past. Let's do a Edwards Notebook sandwich with a Songs and Stories for Soldiers Veterans Tip of the Day in the middle, as Ron has been a little slow to get some of these notebooks to me, and now he's trying to make it up to me, so I've got two to play. Stay with me. I will be back right after this brief break.
The presidential campaign season is just revving up, but it may be the easiest for voters to figure out. Hello, I'm Ron Edwards. On today's page from the Edwards Notebook, both President Trump and his Democrat Party opponent will have their own unique agendas. President Trump's agenda will include growing the U.S. economy. His Democrat opponent's agenda? Stop Trump. The Trump agenda will, of course, include securing the borders. The agenda of Trump's Democrat opponent will be to stop Trump. Low unemployment is also part of the president's agenda. His Democrat opponent will zero in on his or her agenda to stop Trump. Trump's agenda also includes bringing back America's industrial prowess. His Democrat opponent's agenda? Stop Trump. Trump's agenda includes fair trade deals and lower taxes. The Democrat agenda? Stop Trump. Affordable medical care. A further reduction of regulations and improving infrastructure round out the president's agenda, while his one-track pony Democrat opponent's agenda is Stop Trump, which also means to stop America. I'm Ron Edwards. Let's meet Fridays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific on AmericaMatters.us and 12 a.m. Sundays on Talk America Radio Network.
Ron Edwards, the new voice of America.
Sponsored by the Tri-County Liberty Coalition.
This is Dan Perkins with your songs and stories for soldiers, veterans, tip of the day. Do you remember when you were in basic training or your first duty assignment? I do. What about those men and women who trained with you? Have you ever wondered what happened to them? I have. What about some of the people who served with you a good part of the time you were in the military? Ever wonder what happened to them? I have. Do you think they might also be wondering what happened to you? I think so. Would you like to find out? Here is your veteran's tip of the day. Find out about your buddies by joining TogetherWeServed.com. This is a free service, and TWS has reunited over 1.8 million vets in all branches of the service, and they can help you find your friends. You may be surprised at who you can find. This has been your Songs and Stories for Soldiers, Veterans Tip of the Day.
If leftists in California have their way, the Golden State will forever be tarnished. Hello, I'm Ron Edwards on today's page from the Edwards Notebook. Not that long ago, California symbolized a sense of youthful optimism. She was a magnet for those seeking a better opportunity. Her cities were one-time symbols of great civility, especially San Francisco, which was one of the five most beautiful cities on earth. Unfortunately, those of the political left, whose longtime goal has been to collapse our beloved republic, have taken full control of the political reins in that state and are furiously working to literally destroy her via sanctuary cities, being overrun by illegal border crossers, of course, and Skid Row bums. Former Attorney General Eric the Red Holder once made reference to utilizing California as an example of how to collapse America as a whole in order to advance the political agenda of the left, which includes the elimination of free speech, freedom of thought, and opportunities for all, replacing them with misery and godless government control from cradle to grave. My fellow Americans, I believe we shall overcome such madness, but there is no time to waste. Join me Fridays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific on AmericaMatters.us. I'm Ron Edwards.
Ron Edwards, the new voice of America.
Sponsored by the Tri-County Liberty Coalition.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for staying with me through that very brief break, which that was a bit longer than it has been lately, because now I have a full 60-second bit from Songs and Stories for Soldiers, and, of course, doubling up on Ron Edwards. So there you have it. Ron, of course, laying out some interesting stuff with the notebook. And, you know, again, Dan Perkins, Songs and Stories for Soldiers, I've said multiple times, great organization. I highly recommend you do a Google search, check them out. I've been shying away from bringing guests on while we've been having these technical issues, but I have officially booked Dan Perkins. I mentioned the other day it had been a while since he'd been on, maybe a little too long. He'll be joining us for Friday night show, so be sure to rejoin me then. I will, of course, be talking about Donald Trump in the UK. Official visit, of course, will be done by then, and we'll be able to talk about all the shenanigans. Okay, so what are the best methods for judging the health of any organization, be it a large company, a small business, or even a nonprofit group? You can take a look at the issue of employee turnover. That'll usually tell you a lot. If there's a huge turnover, it generally indicates that there is some reason why people are running through. Now, it doesn't necessarily tell you why, but it does point to the possibility that there may be a genuine issue. At any rate, if you're going to use that particular matrix, which I think is a good one to look at, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, better known to everyone as CARE, which bills itself as the nation's preeminent Muslim civil rights organization, well, it appears to be, well, I'm going to say it's fair to call it severely dysfunctional. The organization's list of chapters is constantly being updated with new executive directors start and stop. And as new chapters attempt to rise and others fold, well, today there are 27 CARE affiliates listed, which of course is down from the over 30 in years past. And only 17 are currently led by leaders who have been there for 3 or more years. So many of these chapters actually are without leadership and have been for some time. Now, this is an indicator of something being somewhat amiss. Now, a new lawsuit is kind of providing a little insider account of the day-to-day workings of CARE's largest branch. The four chapters that comprise CARE's California branch, the lawsuit alleges a toxic culture and poor leadership, which suggests CARE's devotion to progressive civil and employment rights practices may be only a facade for something a bit more, well, shall we say, insidious. I'm going to stop right there for a moment. And we've spent some time talking about CARE. We know that CARE seems to be interested in promoting the Muslim Brotherhood agenda. Why do we know this? Because we know that they're primarily run by members of the Muslim Brotherhood. How do we know this? We pay attention. We've looked for these links. We have seen it. We've uncovered it. We've talked about it. I've spent time on this. I know Kel has spent time on this. Annie has spent time on this on her show. We've discussed this quite frequently at times when CARE had been particularly making headlines. So I'm not going to rehash all those connections. It's just that we know they're up to something other than the protection of civil rights. So on April 24th, Suzanne Arani filed a 42-page lawsuit against CARE of California. I'm going to use Suzanne's first name rather than her last name moving forward, just because I don't want to risk butchering it. I don't want to show any disrespect. So Suzanne served as a lawyer in the San Diego office, working on and off since 2015. And on April 9th of 2019, Suzanne was fired by Dustin Cron, her new boss, and a Greenhorn executive director who took over in January. Suzanne alleges discrimination based on religion, gender, age, and political views, breaches of attorney-client privilege, wrongful termination and retaliation, failure to hire, and hostile work environment. See, you have to be careful when you fire lawyers, don't you? So anyway, Suzanne offers multiple allegations against both Cron and the upper levels of CARE California leadership, which happens to be responsible for overseeing him, while at the same time offering a highly suggestive glimpse at the ideology at work behind the walls of CARE, specifically anti-Americanism and sexism seems to run rampant. Suzanne also claims that near the end of February, while considering a much more expensive new office space that featured a large American flag out front, Cron told her, quote, "If I would have to see that flag every day, I'm going to want to put bullets or darts through it. I've been thinking of at least taking the American flag and hiding it in our office so no one has to look at it. In addition, Suzanne also claims that Karan wrote on his Facebook page, quote, "This country is disgusting." Evidently, that happened back on March of 2019. So there's also the expression of frustration for alleged pay disparities between men and women, and further notes that a 2016 through 2017 audit of CARE Los Angeles found it paying its female workers substantially less than it paid its male employees. Now, Suzanne also claims knowledge that CARE California executive director's salaries, asserting that a longtime executive director of CARE in the San Francisco office and lawyer Zahar Bilou, I hope that's the proper pronunciation, made less than non-lawyer Kron. Based on these points and other examples, she basically concludes the quoting in the lawsuit now that said salary differentials and positions for females versus males are the pattern and practice of CARE California. She also alleges sexist statements by Kron, such as asking a male bookkeeper about the office's female workers. Evidently, he asked, "How do you deal with all these girls?" Suzanne lays into Kron, going into detailed allegations about how she regarded him as unqualified. She claims that he, quote, has never worked in an office, never managed staff, never spent any considerable amount of time in San Diego, never fundraised, and has no experience in law, policy, or government. She also alleges that Kron does not work 8 hours a day on a consistent basis and sometimes takes midday naps. Sounds to me like a dream job. Maybe I should join CARE. I wouldn't mind having that kind of a work schedule. I'm going to take a nap. You girls, take care of this out here. Yeah. I would like to know about this. Anyway, other objects. Well, further objections, I should say, that Suzanne has was to her and her co-workers being credit checked for their positions while Kron was not. She alleges that a simple credit check would have eliminated him as a viable candidate for the position of executive director. She further alleges that he yelled at employees, failed to do his primary job of fundraising, insisted on mandatory prayer before staff meetings, and allowed his wife to use the office like it, quote, was her own living room. Now, she also additionally makes more serious legal accusations about the security of confidential client files under Kron's leadership, both before and after her termination. As much as she may take delight in taking vengeance against her former boss with embarrassing personal claims, there actually is a more serious refrain running throughout the legal complaint. Really, this guy was allegedly supported in his actions by the other leaders of CARE California. That's a problem. I mean, if this was any other group in California, they probably already would have been drug out into the streets. At the very least, run out of town on a rail, if you know what I mean. The folks that tend to run those cities pride themselves on being woke. Such behavior is unacceptable, unless, of course, you happen to be a member of another protected class. And then your woke has to be double woke, because then you have to understand, well, that's just cultural. So why is that not a legitimate argument for everyone? Well, because mean old conservatives like me, I'm not part of a protected class, so it's okay to yell and scream and rant and rave about me all day long. All right, so anyway, point of fact, this isn't exactly the first time that a lawsuit kind of aired some of CARE's dirty laundry. There was one that suggested a lot of internal problems kind of the same thing, and that it may be more of an organizationally systemic issue. It took place back in 2008. CARE and CARE Virginia were sued along with CARE Virginia's resident attorney, Morris J. Days. That particular lawsuit alleged that Days, who was not actually an attorney, as it turned out, had taken money from clients for legal services that were never received, and that CARE knew all about it the whole time. The outcome of that lawsuit actually still hasn't been resolved as of yet. It's ongoing. And this should be a pretty much an open and shut case, right? I mean, if that was me practicing law without a legal license to practice law, having not passed the bar, having not spent time at law school, yeah, I would have been ordered to pay back everything plus damages, and I'd probably be sitting underneath the jail somewhere in Virginia right now. Pays to be part of a protected class. Intersectionality is wonderful when you're part of the team. Here's the deal. CARE likes to kind of pitch itself as a social justice organization, and of course is an intersectional alliance with other marginalized groups. The new lawsuit here kind of provides additional allegations that CARE's progressive rhetoric is probably just a cynical activist tactic, and that on the inside, CARE may institutionally practice discriminatory policies, which it would never tolerate if it were done against Muslims and other organizations. Just a little food for thought. All right, so I've got just a few minutes left, and I do have one other story in the show description, so I'm going to struggle to get through that very quickly. It's not something that I need to spend a lot of time with. And again, everything tonight, stuff that has been covered pretty well. Usually I spend a lot of time discussing topics that aren't necessarily getting a whole lot of conversation, aren't being talked about by a whole lot of people. Tonight, everything has kind of fit that bill, and I'll still have to put some stuff on for tomorrow, but Kristen Gillibrand. Gillibrand was on Fox News this past Sunday, giving one of those lovely town halls that Fox News is known for. And the topic of abortion came up. And of course, Kristen, desperate to stand out from the crowd, rather than answer the question as it was actually posed, she decided to attack Fox News. A bit rude, if you will. In fact, the moderator of said town hall said as much. She first tried to blame Fox News coverage of the abortion battle that was heating up going into the 2016 presidential election. And Fox News' insistence on the references to infanticide as loading the questions. Now, as the conversation continued, she did finally acknowledge, after some prodding, that she is for abortion, period, including late term. She didn't use those exact words, so she still has some room to wiggle if it comes down to it. But what she did say is, quote, "The debate about whether or not women should have reproductive freedom has turned into a red herring debate." Now, I'll agree with her with that. The problem is all the red herrings are coming from the left. Now, Gillibrand said this while she was claiming that the network's discussion of infanticide equated to 6.5 hours leading up to Donald Trump's State of the Union address. She continued saying, quote, "That is not the debate and what access to reproductive care is in this country. It doesn't happen. It's illegal It's not a fact. Now, she's referring to infanticide. Now, what she's failing to acknowledge is that New York's late-term abortion and Governor Northam of Virginia's statements in regards to the late-term abortions that he would like to see actually do fit the definition of infanticide. And the truth of the matter is, if you're going to acknowledge that that is a person growing in there, then killing the unborn at any stage can be considered infanticide. She doesn't want to play those reindeer games. She wants to play the typical leftist intellectual gymnastics, where we're going to find a way to ignore the majority of facts, and we're going to twist and control the language. Now, Jill Brown is, of course, one of 44 Democratic senators that voted against a bill that would have required doctors to care for children that survived botched abortions. The Born Alive bill, as you recall, brought to the floor multiple times, voted down by Democrats over and over again. She's also one of the many 2020 Democratic candidates who favor increased abortion access and supports repealing the ban on federal funds being used for abortion. Yeah, we might as well go ahead and pay taxpayer dollars to make sure it's happening. Gillibrand has made identity politics a major part of her campaign. No big surprise. She tweeted last year that the future of America is intersectional and female. Good for her. Now, Gillibrand is consistently polling at 0 or 1% and still hasn't exactly qualified for the first debate that will take place later this month, but she has received a bit of a bump since the town hall. Here's the one thing that tells you all you need to know when it comes to this argument. She specifically stated that abortion has been a constitutional right since Roe v. Wade. She actually used a specific number of years. When you say that something's been a constitutional right for less than the amount of time that the Constitution has been the guiding document of this country, then it's not a constitutional right. She doesn't understand what the Constitution actually is. The Constitution does not bestow rights. And the judicial branch, they may have engaged in some stretching and interpreting of phraseologies to try and develop some half-baked scheme to, as an activist, legislate from the bench and then create a legality for abortion across the board. But anything that is enshrined in the Constitution, anything that is specifically mentioned in the Constitution, if you have a constitutional right, you've had it since the inception of the Constitution, not until the time, point in time when some court decided as so. But your constitutional rights are your human rights. They are your God-given rights. And I'm pretty certain we can make a legitimate argument that God doesn't want you killing unborn children, even though the left is working really hard to convince people that it's actually immoral to try and stop it. It's nuts. It's the kind of cray-cray we've come to expect from our leftist politicians. It's sad, and it's heartbreaking. But that's the current state of the Democratic Party, and it's only going to get worse from there. And I'm going to have to leave things there. I want to thank everybody who joined and who called in and was listening in the chat. Well, listening on the switchboard. Obviously, they couldn't get into the chat room this evening. Thank you guys so very much. Quick reminder that two recent articles that have been published in various websites are in tonight's show description. Feel free to check it out. And remember, don't take my word for it. Definitely, definitely don't take their word for it. Be prepared to put in some effort and, more importantly, to use your brain if you really want to tap into the truth. That's it for now, everybody. Thank you so much.
is using both hands.
Founders knew the Second Amendment was the final one to keep, to hold our other rights intact so we'd never become sheep. Stalin, Hitler, Mao, Amin, and Pol Pot, they told the things that you never forgot.
Is using both hands.
Well, I prefer the 308 to the tiny 223. Gives me more than 1,000 yards to protect my family.
Using both hands.